Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Today on the program, Anne Ball brings us this week's Science in the News report. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly tells us about America's 11th president, James K. Polk. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
For the first 20 years of Marcus Rindt's life, he knew there were limits on how far he could travel. Rindt grew up in East Germany. He could not go farther west than the border wall that divided Germany into two countries. "I grew up with walls around me," he remembers. "It was a weird situation to see that the world seems to end at this wall. You feel that it cannot be that the world ends here." In October 1989, Rindt fled to West Germany through Czechoslovakia with other East Germans. Just 1 month later, the border wall came down. 6 years later, Rindt moved to the city of Dresden. He currently lives in Dresden, where he leads a group of musicians called Dresdner Symphoniker. For the nearly 30 years since the wall came down, Rindt has been making music and traveling. He sometimes expresses his political beliefs through music. Now, Rindt has something to say about the planned border wall between the United States and Mexico. And he wants to say it with a music performance. He wants to bring his orchestra to the U.S.-Mexico border for a music and arts performance. He is raising money through the internet to help finance the project. He hopes the performance will take place on or around June 12th, the 30th anniversary of former U.S. President Ronald Reagan's visit to West Berlin. That was when Reagan called on the leader of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, to tear down the wall between East and West Germany. "Our plan," Marcus Rindt says, "is a very big plan." Rindt told VOA that this project is the most ambitious project so far. "I have no idea if it will work in the end." He strongly objects to U.S. President Donald Trump's plans to extend a wall along the Mexican border. "I feel the project is necessary in our time," he said. "It is not only against this planned Trump wall, but against isolationist attitudes around the world as well. That includes Europe, where last year Britain voted to leave the European Union, and France, where nationalist Marine Le Pen is a leading candidate for president. Rindt believes Mexico's government will approve his plans for a performance on the southern side of the U.S. border. He wants his orchestra to perform with 15 to 20 musicians and a children's singing group from the Mexican city of Tijuana. However, he is not sure whether U.S. officials will let the Mexican musicians and children join his orchestra on the north side in San Diego's Friendship Park. At the park, family members and loved ones on both sides of the border can talk to one another through holes in a closed metal fence. Rindt has never been to the border between the United States and Mexico. He has invited U.S. and Mexican musicians to join the Dresdner Sinfoniker in June. And he has raised more than half the money needed for his orchestra to travel there. Rindt knows he is not the first to attempt a cross-border music performance. Events like these have been happening for years. But Rindt hopes the event will grow hugely popular on social media. He wants musicians and artists to write about their performances using a hashtag linked to Reagan's speech, hashtag tear down this wall. Rindt says he is not ignoring larger issues about the wall. He knows Trump says that the wall is needed for national security. I'm aware of some problems. Drugs, of course, he said. Some people will say to me, what about drugs and criminals? There must be other ways to solve such a problem. Data shows that smugglers do work around border barriers. Trump recently told the Associated Press that people want the border, but more Americans oppose the wall than support it. A public opinion survey from Quinnipiac University shows that 64% of Americans oppose plans to extend the current wall. Just after Trump's election in November, that number was 55%. I'm Alice Bryant.
When people exercise, their bodies sweat and their clothes get wet. And that means their clothes, like their bodies, can smell. This is especially true if they are wearing synthetic clothes, ones made of material not found in nature. These materials, like polyester, are designed to be lightweight, to move sweat away from a person's body, and to dry quickly. But these clothes can keep that bad smell a body makes when it sweats. For years, manufacturers have been making exercise and travel clothes with different kinds of anti-odor technology. Some add chemicals or put small holes in the garments to allow the sweat and smell to escape. Others use threads or small pieces of silver in the fabric. The goal is to make clothes that one can wear longer without having to wash them. That might not sound very pleasant, but it helps people who are carrying all their supplies for camping in the wilderness. Carl Botterud is such a person. For 10 years, the California lawyer and his son have been camping in the High Sierra Mountains for a week at a time. Packing light, he did not want to take 6 pairs of underwear.
I was looking and found underwear that promoted its properties as comfortable, quick drying, and doesn't smell, so you can wear it for multiple days while you're out packing. So that sounded terrific. I bought a couple pair, and they worked exactly as advertised.
Now, he wears them every day at home, too.
Now, when I'm at home, I don't wear them 3 days in a row, but they're very comfortable when I exercise, going for hikes or long walks or going to the gym.
Paul Westerhoff is a professor of environmental engineering at Arizona State University. He researched the effectiveness of silver in clothes to kill bacteria and how it impacts the environment. The study was published in Environmental Science and Technology last year. Researchers use zebrafish embryos to test whether a drug is toxic for humans. In the study, Westerhoff found the fish embryos were not harmed when exposed to silver in wastewater. He says silver is quite toxic or harmful to bacteria, but not for humans. It is also used in bandages and food packaging. In clothing, silver releases ions that kill the bacteria and the smell. Silver is used two ways in clothing. One uses a long thread of silver to cover a large area of the material. The other coats all the fibers with very small pieces of silver called nanoparticles. They cannot be seen with your eye. Some of the silver gets washed away with the washing machine water. Researchers wanted to know if that makes the cloth less effective. So they washed the garments many times.
Even after 6 and up to 20 washings, you still kill over 99% of the bacteria in most cases.
Westerhoff says the nanoparticle silver looks like a better choice. Much less silver is needed for each piece. That costs less, and there is less silver released into the wastewater. He is concerned about the impact of silver on the environment, but he says there is a process to take care of it.
We've done studies to show that most of this silver will go to a wastewater treatment plant where it gets removed with the bacteria. And it's pretty regulated in terms of where they go.
Now, Westerhoff says he wants to find out if people really would wash their clothes less if they do not smell. Less washing helps the environment because less hot water is used. There is less wastewater and less energy is used to dry the material. Washing synthetic clothes less often would also mean less microfibers escaping with the wash water. Recent studies show that very small pieces of these synthetic fabrics come off every time they are washed. These microfibers are plastic and are finding their way to rivers, oceans, into fish, and even table salt in China. Both manufacturers and environmentalists are working to find solutions to this problem. Some people are going back to wearing more wool, a natural fabric for outdoor activities. In the U.S., companies are making garments with merino wool. It is softer, lightweight, and does not itch or hurt your skin. Emma Walker is a writer and outdoor athlete. She says wool is really comfortable and does not smell.
I can wear a wool-based layer next to my skin for days at a time without ever taking it off when I'm in the backcountry, and it doesn't itch.
And she says, except for on the hottest summer days, she can still stay cool in wool. Rita Corliss Samuelson works at the American Wool Council. Because bacteria are not attracted to wool, she says, it does not smell when you do.
You can wear wool and not wash it. I mean, we've been have people wear a wool shirt for 100 days claiming that they're odor-free.
While they may favor one kind of fabric over the other, many athletes wear both wool and synthetics, depending on where they are and what they are doing. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. James Knox Polk moved into the White House as the 11th President of the United States in 1845. Few had predicted that Polk would become president. Even he was surprised. Polk had come to his party's presidential nominating convention nearly a year earlier with low expectations. But the top politicians, including former President Martin Van Buren, failed to win a majority of votes. Convention delegates tried again and again to agree on a candidate. Eventually, Polk was nominated. A small number of delegates supported him. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. He became the first dark horse candidate in U.S. history to be nominated by a major party. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win, but he did. Polk was born in the southeastern state of North Carolina. When he was a child, his family moved west to Tennessee. At the time, Tennessee had few white settlers. Some considered it the wilderness. Polk's family did well there. His father became wealthy, buying land and enslaved people. His mother, Jane, who followed strict Christian religious teachings, gave her 10 children a good education. James was the oldest. He went to college, then studied law. When he was 25, he married an intelligent and wealthy young woman named Sarah Childress. The two never had children, but they worked together to launch Polk's political career. In time, Polk was elected to the Tennessee House of Representatives, then the National House of Representatives. There, he developed a close relationship with President Andrew Jackson. Since Jackson was called Old Hickory, Polk became known as Young Hickory. When Polk left Congress and returned to Tennessee to become governor, he supported Jackson's banking reforms. But soon the U.S. economy collapsed. Tennessee voters failed to reelect Polk as governor, not once, but twice. So Polk returned to his plantations and waited for a chance to re-enter national politics. In 1844, Polk traveled to the city of Baltimore to attend the Democratic Party's national convention. He thought he could perhaps win the nomination for vice president. Instead, he became the Democrats' candidate for president. Several months later, he narrowly defeated the opposing party's candidate in the national election. Historian Robert Mary wrote a book about Polk's presidency. Mary says one reason Polk won the election was the issue of Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading candidates did not. Mary says the other candidates were right. The United States eventually went to war with Mexico. But Polk spoke for the American people. In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west, all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and take control of the continent. As a result, many voters supported Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Several previous presidents had served 2 terms. Polk told voters presidents might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But Robert Mary says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. It was a political bet. Polk thought if he said he would serve as president for only one term, other party leaders might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years, instead of waiting 8. He was probably right. If Polk had not made the campaign promise, Mary says, Young Hickory would not have won. During the first days of his administration, James K. Polk famously listed the 4 things he planned to do as president. He wanted to reduce taxes on imports. He wished to establish an independent treasury. He hoped to settle the dispute with Britain over the Oregon border. And he wanted to get California for the United States. Less than 4 years later, Polk had realized each item on his list. He is remembered for greatly expanding the size of the United States. He successfully negotiated with Britain for U.S. control over territory in the West up to the 49th parallel. The agreement gave the U.S. the current states of Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. Below those states lay California. An American government minister once described California as the richest, the most beautiful, and the healthiest country in the world. The official said, "The port of San Francisco was big enough to hold all the navies of the world." He said, "Someday San Francisco would control the trade of all the Pacific Ocean." There was only one problem from the point of view of the U.S. government. California was part of Mexico. At first, U.S. officials attempted to buy California from Mexico, but Mexican officials refused even to talk about selling California to the United States. Shortly after the U.S. Congress approved statehood for Texas in early 1845, Mexico broke relations with the U.S. altogether. The following year, Mexican troops crossed the Rio Grande and clashed with American soldiers. In answer, President Polk asked Congress to declare war. He did not think the conflict would last long. He believed the U.S. declaration would quickly force Mexico to sell him the territory he wanted. Polk was wrong. Historian Robert Mary says, "The war with Mexico lasted longer, was more expensive, and cost more lives than Polk expected." But in the 1848 treaty that ended the war, Polk got the land he had wanted. Mexico recognized the independence of Texas and did not stop it from joining the United States. And it sold the areas that are now all or part of the states of Arizona, Utah, Nevada, New Mexico, Wyoming, Colorado, and, yes, California. President Polk kept his promise to serve only one term. After 4 years, he retired from the presidency, traveled for a few weeks, and then returned to Tennessee to settle in a new home. But Polk did not have much time there. He had been sick often throughout his life, but he became seriously ill during his travels. Only 3 months after he left the White House, Polk died. He left behind a much larger country, but a divided one. The issue was again slavery. Southerners argued that they had the right to take enslaved people into California and other former Mexican lands. Northerners opposed any further spread of slavery. The question was this: did Congress have the power to control, or even ban, slavery in the new territories? I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.